Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Well, thank you, Teresa.
Thank you for being here and joining us for show number 31.
Well, there we are.
Here okay. We are again.
Yeah. Middle of the 1600s.
1600.
So we've...
Quite a time.
About 300 years of church history already.
We have.
But another 300 and something to go.
Well, good. I hope it takes us another 30 to cover that.
I'm afraid it's going to.
Good. That's good.
Well, you know, we were talking the other day about the whole thing of the general church history, and then at the same time going into some depth, sort of topics that are under the radar screen.
Right.
You know.
Right.
The other day I got asked about textbooks and recommend some possible textbooks for general reading and in church history. And I think I've mentioned some of these before also. And I recommended Alan Schreck's book, his History of the Church. Unfortunately, it's a very brief book. I that's what he wanted to write, but it's about 120, 130 pages, and so that's a good one. But if you want to get below the general history of what happened and get into particulars, then you really want to turn to somebody like Warren Carroll, and he's got this wonderful 4-volume set. He still has another, I think, 2 volumes yet to go. And this is the from Christendom Press, and he goes into great detail. For a lot of people, it would be too much, but it certainly gives you all that background. So, like for instance, the other week when we had the opportunity to spend time and just talk about seminary life at San Sulpice, that's something that normally you wouldn't hear much about,
right?
You know.
I don't know where else we hear it. So it's good. That's in William Carroll's book.
He
covers part of that.
He covers a little of that. I got a lot of that actually from some people who were the biographies of priests who had graduated from San Sulpice.
Okay.
William Battersby's book, his biography of St. John Baptist de La Salle, covers quite a bit of that. And there are some others also. There's a biography of Louis de Montfort also. And though I haven't had a chance to break that one open, it's in my to-read column. Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh.
But, yeah, so.
So Carroll's book will give us a deeper study of what is involved in more in church history. And then you've taken from some of those pieces and researched more from that.
Right, yeah. In many cases, I find myself using books that some of them are quite old, and you won't find them outside of a seminary library. You got to go down into the bottom floor of the seminary library and blow off the dust and you know, crack them open and scare away the spiders and all that. But they're wonderful sources. And interestingly enough, when I look at the footnotes that Warren Carroll uses, many, many times he's using those same sources. So he's got some really, really solid history that he turns to in writing his history and making it all the more contemporary.
Wonderful.
You know, because Teresa, quite honestly, a lot of the books that are written in the 19th century are very flowing and they're very hard for 21st century people to read because they're you've got to read between the lines to get the facts.
Oh, okay.
And this is one thing that Warren Carroll has done is he's distilled a lot of that and brought the basic history into contemporary voice.
Great.
Yeah, so that's kind of neat. Well, anyway, I thought today, you know, in the last couple sessions, we've been talking about sort of the flowers of the of the 17th century,
yeah.
Jean-Baptiste de La Salle, the founding of the Christian Brothers, the schools, education systems, the idea of the parochial grade school, the parish grade school, the petite école, as it was called in those days, and a number of other things. But I thought it might be good to go down in the plant and get down to some of the roots today, actually look at where some of this came from. And, of course, there's one individual in France that just stands out, and that's Vincent de Paul.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And he was born actually in 1580. So he was 20 years old when the century got started. He was a poor family. He was from a peasant family in the area of Gascony, which is in southwestern France. And nonetheless, somehow the family found a way to get him an education, and so he was sent to school, studied humanities. So I was taking basically what we would call today a liberal arts degree.
Okay.
And then after that went on to study theology and then was ordained for the priesthood in 1600. So he's around 20 years old when he was ordained.
Wow, he was pretty young.
Relatively young, yeah, a young priest. He was ordained in Toulouse, which is a city in southern France. And as I say, 20 years old, and everything seemed to be going just fine for him. Nice, quiet life, he thought. And then the first exciting thing that came along was he discovered that he was going to get an inheritance. But to get that, he had to go to Marseille, city in southern France, also on the Mediterranean coast.
Okay.
So he went over, got his inheritance, and was taking a ship back, sailing along the northern Mediterranean, when his ship was attacked by Barbary pirates.
Oh, no.
These are Muslim pirates, and they had been operating for centuries in the western Mediterranean. If you know your American history, you know about the Barbary pirates and, mm-hmm. and the Americans, how our young nation went ahead and put a stop to these guys. Believe it or not, France and Spain and England and all the other great maritime powers never put these guys down. They tried occasionally, but never succeeded. And in the end, the big maritime powers found that it was cheaper just to pay them off.
Wow.
You know, and along comes the United States. We didn't have any money to bribe them, and so any ship flying the Stars and Stripes was fair game,
mm-hmm.
and so we had to solve that problem in a different way. But this, of course, was about a century and a half later, almost 2 centuries later than poor Vincent de Paul, and so he got taken.
Oh, and his inheritance, I assume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what happened then is that he was taken to North Africa.
Oh, he not just his money was taken.
Oh yeah, no, he was sold as a slave.
Oh my! Okay.
In the slave markets of Tunis, and so then he ended up being a slave to a Muslim, and this continued on. His state of slavery continued on until 1607. And then he didn't escape from his owner, but rather he converted his owner to Christianity.
Oh, he converted a Muslim. Okay.
Yeah, and so it became too dangerous for the Muslim owner,
right.
You know, the new Christian owner, to stay, and so the two of them escaped to France.
Wow.
And I don't know what happened to the convert.
That's pretty good influence.
But yeah, pretty incredible. Anyway, Vincent de Paul then returns to France in 1607 after having had this terrible experience of having been enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, I think sometimes we find that Christian slaves make the best Christians in Christian missionaries. When you think back, St. Patrick, remember?
Right.
As a boy, had been captured by Irish pirates and taken over to Ireland, used as a slave for a number of years. Think back, also, one of our earliest popes was a slave, Pope Clement.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. And when he was elected pope, he is the first pope to change his name, and he did it in honor of the Clementine family, which he had been a slave of. You know, and so he becomes Pope Clement the First.
Okay.
Anyway, sometimes, you know, slavery brings something out in people, and it certainly did in St. Vincent de Paul. Here's a fellow that comes back, now he's still relatively young, he's about 27 years old, and he finds himself in the city of Avignon,
okay.
Which of course has a long
back again.
History. Yeah, and while he's there, he is in the service of a priest who is a papal diplomat.
Oh, okay.
Serving in Avignon. And when the diplomat is recalled back to Rome, he takes Vincent de Paul with him. And so now he's in Rome and involved in a number of things. At the time, the Pope wanted to have contact with the King of France, Henry IV. If you remember, Henry of Navarre, mm-hmm. he had been that Huguenot during the French Civil Wars and had married Marguerite of Valois and had converted in the end to Catholicism.
Right.
And so, anyway, he's in France, and the Pope wanted to have a mission to him, but it had to be a secret mission. And so, St. Vincent de Paul was asked to take that role and to make deliver a special message from the Pope to King Henry IV. And so, I mean, he's really hobnobbing in some circles now.
Uh-huh.
You know, from being a peasant, a Gascon peasant, to being a galley slave, to now, you know, being an envoy, papal envoy to the King of France. Anyway, he gets there, and he impresses the Queen incredibly. Marguerite of Valois is very much impressed with him, and so she asks him to do a number of tasks also while he's there. Well, this is kind of short-lived because shortly after his arrival, evidently the king and queen didn't get along all that terribly well, and Henry IV divorced his wife.
Right.
And so she was taken from court, and just a couple years after that, Henry himself was assassinated, and he was stabbed to death. And Well, that ended Vincent de Paul's intimate relations with the royalty. He was then hired as a chaplain for a very prominent family, a noble family that was close to the royal court. And this was the Gondi family.
Okay.
It's G-O-N-D-I. And he was hired as their family chaplain. Many wealthy Europeans did that at that time, had their own private chaplains,
mm-hmm.
and also he tutored their children, so that humanities degree came in
right.
came in handy. Yeah, it's during that time that we know that he began to preach missions. This was a popular movement in the 1600s. The idea of preaching missions, going to parishes and preaching retreats or missions to these parishes. Certainly, St. Alphonsus Liguori turns this into a fine art with the Redemptorists.
Mm-hmm.
But this is several years before that, of course, almost a century before that. We can think of, for instance, Francis de Sales, who left his own diocese in Geneva and occasionally would go to France, in fact every year would go to France and preach retreats in parts of France. That's where he met Jane Frances de Chantal, and then she of course was inspired so much as to found the Visitation Order.
Right.
So you have, you know, this preaching of retreats, and so he got involved in that. Somewhere along the line, he got attached to a parish and became the pastor of the parish, but only for 5 months. not all that terribly long.
That was very short term as pastor.
And I don't know why.
Okay.
Whether it had anything to do with the parish, or it certainly had something to do with the Gondi family, who wanted him back.
Oh, okay. And they were influential. So.
Yes, and they were influential. So he found himself back tutoring their kids again and being their chaplain.
Okay.
But now he had a message. He had a message that he had not had so much before, and that was a real strong sense of helping the poor. And his whole life began to revolve around that. I found some interesting quotes a little bit later on. I'll read a couple of those. And his love for the poor becomes just so very important into who he is and what he does. One of the things that he used to say was, he said, extend your mercy toward others so that there can be no one in need whom you meet without helping.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everyone you come in contact with, anyone that needs help, make sure that. And then he said, for what hope is there for us if God should withdraw His mercy from us.
None at all.
You know, so if we realize that, right, then certainly we should be doing the same for others. He also, coming back to the Gandhis, he recognized that, you know, Vincent de Paul was one of those guys that could look at you and know what your talents were and where your treasures were and know how to tap those for the good of others. And Monsieur de Gondi happened to have a very important position in the government. He was the master general of all the galleys in France.
Oh, my. Okay.
Hey, and you know, the galleys are ships that are basically propelled by oars.
Right. I keep thinking of Ben-Hur.
Yeah, well, that's a good example. Yeah, that's and unfortunately, the technology hadn't changed much in 2,000 years. So all throughout France, and we always think of these galleys as big warships. Mm-hmm. They were also the barges and regular longshore
commercial traffic,
yeah, of the day. And so in every major city you had these galleys. Now, they were not operated by mechanical oars.
Mm-hmm.
They were operated by oarsmen. And these guys were not there because they were working out.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were convicts. You didn't have slaves like you'd had in the Muslim countries, but you did have convicts. And so if someone was sent to prison, rather than sending him to prison, oftentimes they would send him to a galley, and then he would spend his time rowing.
Mm.
And the conditions were absolutely miserable. There are a number of galley convicts that are known throughout history. One of those, best known, is John Knox.
Oh, wow.
The founder of the Presbyterian Church was himself a galley convict for a number of years. Well, anyhow.
A few did actually work their time off without
expiring
first.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, many of them did. Mm-hmm. The conditions were absolutely terrible. You were down in the hull of this boat. It was dank. It was cold in the wintertime, hot in the summertime. The food was absolutely horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically black bread that had most of it was stale.
Ugh.
Or worse, it had varmints in it.
Ugh.
And that was sometimes the only way you got any protein, was eating the bugs in the bread.
Oh.
You know, the water was putrid. You know, that you
stale
drank
seawater, I'm sure, in the.
Well, it wouldn't be seawater.
Oh, you're okay. Right.
It was,
right.
It was
in the,
regular water, but
mm-hmm.
but of course, you know, you can imagine that water sitting in a
sitting
barrel.
Water is not with a bunch of men who haven't bathed.
Well, yeah, that
and
wasn't
a real
thing.
And yeah, it cannot be a pretty sight.
Well, this is the group that Vincent de Paul became interested in, and
mm-hmm.
he turns to Monsieur de Gondi and he asks if he could get permission to go to the these oarsmen, the galley convicts in Paris,
right.
and help them, and he got permission to do that. He and another priest, and they began going literally from galley to galley,
wow.
and ameliorating the problems that these men had. If they were sick, they would see to it that they were taken care of. If it was a question of food, they were trying to get them better than food, getting them in contact with their families so that they could be some correspondence, you know, all those sorts of things. And he begins ministering to the needs. Interestingly mm-hmm. enough, the King of France is told of this. Now, this is Louis XIII. And he placed Vincent de Paul over all the charities for all of the galley convicts in all of France. And so Vincent de Paul began working then toward building up a network of people who would come and take care of these galley convicts. First of all, in Paris itself, and then as time went on, he extended the mission down to Marseille, which is a huge port city, and then also to Bordeaux, one of the other major cities in France. And so this good work is then spreading throughout all of France in doing that.
I would assume before him there probably wasn't even such a position.
Right.
Charitable.
Yeah.
That was not a concern charitable needs.
It was not a concern. It was something that people didn't think of.
Mm-hmm.
He's really the one that saw the poor and then was moved to and motivated to do something charitable to help them in their straits.
And he had experience with that. He knew what the situation from being a galley servant.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And that's so true of him also in his life. He takes his own experiences
mm-hmm.
and then through compassion is able to move himself and others to this.
He's seen all sides then, really. He started out poor.
Yeah.
And he then lived and worked with the wealthy in serving the Gandhi family. And then he lived in a galley. And
yeah. and notice the way he brings them together.
Right.
Two groups that would never have anything to do with each other.
No.
Very, very wealthy people who are involved with the royal court. And he brings them into contact with galley convicts who mm-hmm. certainly would have no relationship with
right.
you know anyone wealthy. So.
So now he's taken away from the Gandhi family if he's doing this service. Then
he is actually still very much involved with the Gandhi.
Okay.
In fact, he prevails upon Madame de Gandhi, you know, the mistress
mother,
of the
okay.
house,
uh-huh.
yeah, to help him in establishing a religious congregation,
uh-huh.
because he realizes that the work that he's doing is going to pass, and when he passes, and he wanted to make sure that this would be around forever, and so with her help, he then founds the congregation of priests of the mission. Now known as the Congregation of the Mission,
okay.
are the known as the Vincentians.
Ah, okay.
Nicknamed after St. Vincent,
uh-huh.
of course. And these were, you know, these were my own professors at the seminary, Kenrick Lennon Seminary. They were very much involved here in the Archdiocese of St. Louis. Our first bishop. We always think of William DeBorg as our first bishop, but actually our first bishop of this diocese was Rosati, who himself was a Vincentian.
Oh, okay.
And mm-hmm. our vicars general for many years were Vincentians, right-hand men working side by side with our bishops and building this diocese up. Certainly all the wonderful work they did in Perry County and
right.
in Perryville, the seminary that was down there for many, many years, St. Mary's of the Barons, the wonderful shrine that's down there today mm-hmm. is a real testament to his order that he founds in the early 1600s that we find still this diocese being blessed with today. Well, the order itself is actually most known for its work in seminaries, and it's an interesting story as to how Vincent de Paul founds this order and then ends up using him for seminary training, rather than some of the other projects that he perhaps had in mind. What happened was this: that it was recognized throughout his lifetime. It was recognized that Vincent de Paul was a man that, if you wanted to be religious, a religious Catholic, you wanted to know this man. You wanted to be near him. Sort of like a Mother Teresa of his day.
Uh-huh.
You know, people just wanted to be around Mother Teresa. They just love to be around Pope John Paul II.
Right.
You know, even if it's you're one out of 8 million
That's
people,
right.
you know, like in Mexico City, you know, last year, you just feel this intimate touch of this holy man. And so it was with Vincent de Paul in his own day. And in 1628, one of the bishops of France, the Bishop of Beauvais, asked him to give a retreat for his seminarians. Now, you have to keep in mind that seminaries, as we talked about with Saint-Sulpice, were really catch-can operations. The Council of Trent had mandated that seminaries be set up for the training of new priests not only their intellectual formation, but also their spiritual formation. And how that was done was not spelled out. And so there was a lot of experimentation and evolution over this period. Also, at this point, the great seminary of Saint-Sulpice had not yet been founded. It'll be about 15 or 20 years later before Father Ollier sets that up. And so there isn't a real benchmark to work with. And so even now, seminary, at that time, seminary preparation was kind of haphazard.
Mm-hmm.
To give you an example of that, in France, over about a 50-year period, 60-year period, since the Council of Trent, 20 seminaries had been established, and 10 of them had been closed already.
Oh my goodness!
So okay. There, you know, it was.
Attempts were being made.
Yeah.
To carry through, but
yeah, but not a lot of success.
Hadn't, right.
Yeah. You know. So what the Bishop of Beauvais asked was that St. Vincent de Paul would take a 10-day retreat with his seminarians, that they would come together, and for 10 days he would give them a retreat. And he did. And it was an incredible success. These men were just very, very motivated, as you can well imagine,
mm-hmm.
coming in contact with a saint like this. And so he does this 10-day retreat, and then the bishop then asked him if he would do another one, but that he asked if it could be a little bit longer,
okay.
You know, and Vincent said yes, and he did that. So the next year he did it, but then other bishops also had their men sent to this extended retreat, which was now about a month or 2 months long.
Okay.
The year after that, can we do it a little bit longer? Well, anyway, within a half dozen years, it ended up being a retreat that went on anywhere between 2 and 3 years long.
Ah, nice training.
That's training. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that is definitely spiritual formation.
Right.
And so these seminarians then, before they went off to the university to take their degrees in theology, would spend 2, maybe 3 years with Vincent de Paul and other Vincentians, other
mm-hmm.
Congregation of the Mission priests, who would work on the formation, the spiritual formation, particularly prayer life of these future priests. And eventually, I mean, the retreat itself grew into courses of study.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sure.
So you can see the structure already beginning to form.
Mm-hmm.
And now all you need is a building. And
yeah.
And he did that too in 1635. Vincent purchased and built up a seminary on its own. It was called the Collège de Bon Enfant, the College of the Good Boys, Good Children.
Yeah.
He got lots of help from lots of people. Even St. Vincent de Paul even received a huge donation from Cardinal Richelieu.
Oh, wow.
1,000 gold crowns were given as part of this project by none other than Richelieu. So he was able to get blood out of turnips.
Really?
Well, by the time he died in 1660, there were 11 Vincentian seminaries set up in France. This
wow.
continued to grow, as did the CMs, the Congregation of the Mission. And by 1789, when everything comes to a crashing halt because of the French Revolution,
mm-hmm.
by 1789, there were 53 major seminaries in France run by the Vincentians, along with another 9 minor seminaries.
How beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And you can imagine, though, if you got 53 major seminaries, how many seminarians are coming through
right.
those year by year being ordained had a tremendous impact and influence on the priests and therefore on the church of France.
Definitely.
The most famous of all of these seminaries is going to be Saint-Lazare.
Okay.
And in fact, it's so famous that one of the nicknames that Vincentians receive, besides the nickname of Vincentians, is the Lazarists.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's where that term comes from. Oh. There, not only is the place used for seminaries, but it's also used for conferences on spiritual life. And this is another thing that St. Vincent did often. It's all part and parcel of those retreat missions
mm-hmm.
that he had been giving, going back to the days when he was with the Gondi family.
Okay, okay.
And he attracted lots of people.
These were for lay people then?
These were for lay people, but also priests.
Oh, okay.
And priests came, and some of them gave conferences as well as hearing them. Vincent gave many of them, but he didn't give them all. One of those, interestingly enough, who is involved in this was Father Tronson. If you remember a couple weeks ago when we were talking about Saint-Sulpice, he was one of the most prominent professors at Saint-Sulpice. He himself is one of the first of the Sulpicians.
All right.
And he's that that jolly, very humane,
humanitarian priest. Side, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so he was involved with these conferences. Another later on makes quite a name for himself is Father Bossuet, who later becomes Bishop Bossuet, and is a tremendous orator and writer. We'll probably be saying a couple things about him a little bit later on. It's believed that as many as 800 people attended these conferences every year. And so since it was done year after year, there were literally over 10,000 people who had had the opportunity to make this these conferences.
That had to make a significant impact on the life of the people in France.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did, because then just the outpouring of charity that comes from that, I think, you know, that you can see by the fruits.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, and there's one case where it got to be so so crowded that one of the brothers who was in charge of the rooms came to St. Vincent and said, there are too many people. There's a man showed up and we don't have a room for him. And St. Vincent's response was, well, give him mine. I don't know where St. Vincent lived, but, you know, that was typical of him to be like that. He also established another group that he wanted to work with the poor directly, and so he established an order of women. As much as he established the order of men, the Congregation of the Mission, he also built up then a group known as the Daughters of Charity.
Oh, okay.
And these were to help the poor, and basically these were wealthy women who joined this society, and they raised money in order to help the poor. And then what they did was, because many of the poor were sick and needed direct service, what they did was they sent their servants to go help them.
Oh.
And this is not exactly
what he was looking for.
That's right. Yeah. So they had a little work to do on their spiritual formation. But
the thought was there.
Yeah, and some of them did start doing that work, and this becomes then the center of the Daughters of Charity, which once again is a tremendous order that's been a real blessing to the church, and certainly the church here in St. Louis.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. He used various conferences in various parishes around Paris. So in other words, you have the city of Paris with all of these various parishes, urban parishes, and then Vincentian conferences for study of the truths of the church, the doctrines of the church, the study of the application of that through charitable works, and so the Daughters of Charity find themselves in this context. And what he's doing through all of this is he's bringing the rich to the poor, and so there's a direct contact with the two. Such had not been the case in the past. You know, and one of the real masterminds behind this is a Madame Legras that helps him establish then the daughters and builds this up. There's another group that he also establishes, which will not be women who will become religious, but rather be a group of charitable lay women who are going to once again raise money. These were called the Ladies of Charity.
Oh.
Okay, they are 200 of the most well-heeled women in Paris.
Okay.
These are very, very wealthy women, and their whole project was to raise money to help support a house for the homeless, for the destitute. It's called the Hotel Dieu, and sort of like God's hotel. And there they assisted as many as 20,000 people a year.
That's wonderful. That must have made a significant impact. And you brought the most wealthy, influential women to serve the neediest.
Yeah. And
he really
this
did
is,
bring them together, didn't he?
Yeah, that's it. And you know that I think that's the whole thrust behind his life is this wonderful way of bringing people together, to opposites together. Look how he brought himself, you know, a Christian, a Catholic priest, a slave to this Muslim, and you have this great conversion. The Gandhi family, Louis XIII, Henry IV, I mean, you know, the kings, and brings them right into ameliorating, helping to solve the problems of the people who are the most forgotten, you know, the galley convicts. We see this time after time. And then at the same time, his instilling this zeal for charity into the next generation. Through his seminaries, through his order of priests, the Congregation of the Mission, through his order of nuns, the Daughters of Charity, and through this lay group, the Ladies of Charity.
And getting them together, then the people can see the value of people in need have just as much value as anyone else.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, let me go ahead and take a moment and read you something he says about the poor. It's just it's kind of a long quote, but it's just a really beautiful one. He says this: even though the poor are often rough and unrefined, they must not be judged from their external appearances, nor from the mental gifts that they seem to have received. On the contrary, if you consider the poor in the light of faith, then you will observe that they are taking the place of the Son of God, who chose to be poor. You know, and there's one of those aspects of when somebody comes to you, and if you treat them like the Son of God, Jesus Himself, you can't help, you know.
Right.
Well, he goes on and he says, although in his passion he almost lost the appearance of a man, he's quoting from Scripture there, and was considered a fool by the Gentiles and a stumbling block by the Jews, he showed them that his mission was to preach to the poor. He sent me to preach the good news to the poor, he quotes Jesus. We also ought to have the same spirit and imitate Christ's actions. That is, we must take care of the poor, console them, help them, and support their cause. You know, so I'll give you another quote. He says, it is our duty to prefer service of the poor to everything else and to offer such service as quickly as possible. Charity is certainly greater than any rule. Moreover, all rules must lead to charity. With renewed devotion, then, we must serve the poor, especially the outcasts and the beggars. They have been given to us as our masters and patrons.
Wow.
Now, what a reversal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the Gandhi family was his master and his patron,
right.
You know, and now he's reversing that. You can imagine that those galley convicts, now he looks upon them with the same regard and the same respect as the Gandhi family itself.
Right.
What a wonderful way of looking at the poor, huh?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Something for us all to remember. Good words to keep in mind.
You know, and right in the midst of his life, he's having a very successful life.
He has been fruitful.
Yes, and doing, you know, really wonderful things. And in the process of this, he is called to the deathbed of the king. Louis
XIII. Okay.
And the man is on his deathbed, and he says the following. He says, if I am restored to health, I shall appoint no bishop without spending 3 years with you.
Oh.
What he's basically saying there is that, and remember that the kings at this time were able to make the appointments of bishops.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the pope, of course, that would give the apostolic mandate. But what he's saying here is that you have to... you have to be an alumnus.
You can be healed.
Yeah. Well, that didn't work. The king died anyway. But it was a nice compliment.
Right, yes.
His widow, Queen Anne, however, did what she could, and what she did was appoint Vincent de Paul to an organization called the Council of Conscience. They were the ones who would make the nominations to the king as to who would be the next bishop.
Mm-hmm.
And so he used that position to make sure that the priests who were, whose names were being put forward were good and holy men, and that they were also Orthodox. Remember, this is a time of lots of Jansenism.
Oh, that's right.
You know?
This is, mm-hmm.
And in fact, there was one Jansenist in particular that a little bit later on we'll see that was a real opponent of Vincent de Paul,
mm-hmm.
and did not get to be a bishop, mainly through the efforts of Vincent de Paul. But it all ends well. While this is going on, where he now has this influence with making of bishops, where he is running all of these charities and these religious orders, all of these seminaries are getting up and going. France is not a happy place. There is a low level war. It's not exactly violent, but it's very contrarian going on between, on the one hand, the queen and her chief advisor. This now is Cardinal Mazarin. He had been taught and brought in. He was an understudy for Cardinal Richelieu, and so he is then running the government while Louis XIV is yet a boy and not able to be king yet. Anyway, you have the government is set against a lot of people in Paris, and certainly the poor. And so there was this great tension. It got to be so bad that the queen and her government had to move out of the city itself. And so it was a real question. And Vincent was caught in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went to Cardinal Mazarin and recommended that he reconcile with the people and that they come to some agreements. Mazarin would have none of it. He balked at the very idea. So St. Vincent went back to Paris, and by this time the city was in utter chaos.
Mm-hmm.
There was no commerce going on. People were starving, and so he went throughout the city and organized soup kitchens for the poor.
Mm-hmm.
He fed, these soup kitchens fed between 15 and 16,000 people a day. Day after day, these people came back. It was the only way for them to get nourishment.
15 to 16,000 people a day.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is in 1649, and it's a it's a period of church, of French history known as the Fronde. A game that little Parisian urchins played. What they did was they would... these are street kids, okay?
Right.
And for fun, they didn't have Game Boys back then. So for fun, what they did was they would watch these wealthy people come by in their carriages and all their finery and flu-flus and all that. And they would run out and grab horse droppings in the street, of which there was plenty, of course, because
uh-huh.
there were a lot of horses. And they would make snowballs out of these.
Whoa.
And they would pelt the rich.
Oh,
them.
My gosh.
Well, that's only part of the game. That's the beginning part. The next part of the game happens when the carriages would stop and the coachman and guards or whatever would jump out of the coach and go chasing after the kids.
On.
And then they would run them, a couple blocks. And then the kids would just disappear.
They knew where they were.
Yeah, mm-hmm. into the sewers and into the back, alleys and everything else. And so almost never were these kids actually caught. The Fronde, then, on a national level or a governmental level, is this low-level, let's call it mudslinging. A little bit cleaner. Back and forth with the government.
Uh-huh.
And in the end, in 1649, there is a settlement that's made and things settle down and all that. But it's really Vincent's Christian charity that prevails
mm-hmm.
in all of that, those terrible times. I guess in the end you could say three significant things about Vincent de Paul that, besides all that we've said so far. And one is that although he is Orthodox, he is, for him, charity is above even that. The man that I had mentioned before that he kept from becoming a bishop was the Abbé de Saint-Cyran, who is a famous or infamous Jansenist. Mm-hmm. And throughout his life, he was thwarted by Vincent. But when he died, Saint Vincent was there. At his funeral.
Oh.
You know, so there were things that went beyond charity, went beyond everything else. He had raised money. I've told you about a number of charities that he had, but one of the charities that he did also was raise money for galley slaves. And he succeeded in ransoming back some 1,200 Christians who had been seized and enslaved by the Barbary pirates.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. And so throughout his life, that was another special thing that he had done. And then the last thing to mention is his incredible correspondence. He kept up a correspondence that was just phenomenal. We have some 7,000 of his letters. I just gave you a couple quotes from some of those. But we have 7,000 letters that he had written. It's estimated that there were perhaps as many as 30,000 letters.
When did he ever have time to do that?
Oh, I don't know. Goodness. I mean, when I look, just think about my own correspondence. I don't even do that many emails.
I don't know.
I receive that many emails.
And how quick and easy that is. But
yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So this is a man who's just incredibly engaged with life around him, at the same time a very spiritual man.
Oh, definitely.
You know, everything was motivated out of his spirit.
Right, and that's why so many were drawn to him.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. It has to be.
It has to be. I mean, otherwise, who would have been able to convince that many people of means to assist the needy?
Yeah. Here are a couple of other interesting quotes. You know, one might think that you'd get a big head leading a life like this. But he spoke often about humility, and I've got two really, I think, good little quotes from St. Vincent de Paul about humility. And one of those goes this way. It says, "The most powerful weapon to conquer the devil is humility."
Mm-hmm.
And now he's going to explain why, and it's really good logic. He says, "For as he, the devil, does not know at all how to employ it," right? What does he know about humility? "Neither does he know how to defend himself against it."
Ah.
So then the quote is the following. He says, "Humility and charity are the two master chords." So like music chords,
right.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
So here he's tying together humility and charity. Okay. Says, one, the lowest, the other, the highest.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All the others are dependent on them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And therefore it is necessary above all to maintain ourselves in these two virtues. For observe well that the preservation of the whole edifice depends upon the foundation and the roof. So here, you know, he's telling people to be charitable and humble at the same time. That's a real important aspect, too. Sometimes one of the greatest difficulties in being charitable is lording it over mm-hmm. other people and judging other people,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's one of the things he wants to avoid as much as possible. So those are just a couple little quotable quotes from St. Vincent de Paul.
Great.
Yeah.
What a life. My goodness, the life, the lives he touched, the people he touched,
yeah.
the world he changed. I mean, look at now, even today, the wonderful work that the people who, with the St. Vincent de Paul societies that we have today,
right.
you know, that has
remembering,
come down.
Yeah, and remembering that St. Vincent did not found the St. Vincent de Paul societies. That comes much later. We'll talk about that.
Right, but still modeled after what, you know, what he began.
Yeah, and that same spirit, that idea of service to others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Catholic Charities here in St. Louis always has that motto that we don't serve others because they're Catholic. We serve others because we're Catholic.
Right.
That's what we do. We do what we do because of that. And that's that motivation. It You know the Vincentian spirit is there when you hear or overhear somebody working at the St. Vincent de Paul Society or one of the Catholic Charities organizations that someone says, oh, thank you for what you've done. And the person turns around and says, oh, no, thank you. And it was an honor to serve you. You know, then you know the Vincentian spirit is alive and well, and the charity is linked with humility.
Yes.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is to remember that one of the things about the genius of Vincent de Paul is that at the same time that there are people going all over the world, and we'll talk about this next time around, the extension of world missions really under the leadership of Pope Gregory XV, but the extension of missions all over the world, Vincent de Paul has a temporal sense or a chronological sense of evangelization. Not only are we called to go to the corners of the earth to evangelize and to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ, but we also do the same thing to those who are in the next generation.
Right.
So as the next generation is coming forward, for those people who are already needing to hear the word, and this is that idea of the home mission that he's really gives us that insight into.
All right. Well, Father, thank you very much.
Okay.
Excellent program on St. Vincent de Paul. Really, what a life.
Yeah, what a life.
What a life, right. Well, just briefly, tell us maybe where we're going to
go next.
Look next week.
Okay, we're going to see another extension of mission efforts. We've already seen the mission efforts, especially when we look at American history, of the early 1500s on the heels of the exploration of people like Christopher Columbus, mm-hmm. and then the tremendous conversions that take place certainly in the Western Hemisphere. The Aztecs and the Mayas and others. What we're going to look at next time around is about 100 years, over 100 years after this, there is a new spreading of the gospel, which is done this time in India, in China, in Vietnam, in Africa, both in West Africa and in East Africa, and then also in South America in an area that had not been really touched before, Paraguay. And by and large, these efforts are unsuccessful. There are great efforts made, great names involved in this, people like Father Nobili and Father Matteo Ricci and others, but the great fruits of conversion do not take place. We'll see about a century or so after that, another Pope Gregory, about a century and a half later, this is Gregory the 16th, is going to do the same thing all over again, and it will plant seeds for the tremendous expansion of the church to all ends of the globe. But we'll be looking at the effort that does not succeed.
Okay.
And so often, when you study history, you look at all the successes, and you want to study the successes. Sometimes it's important also to study the failures, and
sure.
you can learn some lessons from that too.
Usually more from our failures.
Yeah.
We
usually
learn more from our mistakes than we do from our
that's
successes.
That's right. So we're going to next week. We'll be looking at some noble efforts.
All right.
Good.
Sounds great. And shall we close with a prayer today?
Let's do, okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now,
and
ever
shall be, world without end. Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.